Do you have an insatiable curiosity about the world? Do you find yourself provoking conversations with your friends and coworkers? Are you a strong listener? Then you should consider applying to become the next host of A Public Affair, WORT's daily hour-long call-in talk program. We're now accepting applications for this volunteer position. The next host will be the voice of Tuesday's show and join a stellar lineup of folks who engage listeners in conversations on social, cultural, and political issues of importance every day of the week. We're looking for someone who is curious and well-informed, comfortable speaking on air, someone who can think on their feet, and has at least 5 hours a week to prepare and host the show. And of course, we'll need you to be here every Tuesday from 12 to 1 p.m. Apply by May 2nd. To find out more information or apply, go to wortfm.org/talkhost.
Good morning and welcome to Her Turn, a program of news and information by and about women. I'm Christina Kivlin. On today's program, an increasingly authoritarian U.S. government continues to disappear people critical of the genocide in Gaza with this week's kidnapping of a doctoral student off the streets of Somerville, Massachusetts. Latin American women are increasingly opting against motherhood. The abuser-in-chief cuts research funding to protect pregnant women from domestic violence because he thinks it's DEI. Trump's labor cuts could make the gender wage gap, already a problem, easier to hide. And all eyes are on Wisconsin for our Supreme Court election, but don't miss the voter ID referendum that will also be on the ballot. So stay tuned for all this and more on the Sunday, March 30th, 2025 edition of Her Turn. Over 1,000 protesters gathered near Tufts University Wednesday after masked plainclothes immigration agents snatched Rumayesa Ozturk, a Tufts PhD student, from the streets of Somerville, Massachusetts, Tuesday evening. Ozturk is a doctoral student in the school's Department of Child Study and Human Development. She's a research assistant at Tufts Children Television Project. She's also a former Fulbright scholar who was born in Turkey. Two reporters from Democracy Now! Went to the protest. Amy Goodman introduces the audio.
Rumayesa Ozturk was making her way with friends to a meal to break her Ramadan fast. Tufts University's president said the school had no prior notice of her arrest. Last March, Ozturk wrote a piece in the student newspaper criticizing Tufts' response to Palestinian solidarity protests on campus, which were calling for divestment from Israel. Democracy Now!'s Hani Massoud and Ariel Boone were in Somerville at Wednesday night's protest.
And immigrants are under attack. What do we do? And students are under attack. What do we do?
I am Fatima Ahmed. I am executive director of Muslim Justice League. I want to start with an attorney statement to clarify. I am not Rumayesa's attorney, but this is a statement shared from her attorney, Masa Khambabai, just to start us off. Thank you all for coming out to support Rumayesa this evening. I hope to speak with her soon and will be telling her about the outpouring of love and support. Unfortunately, I recently received word that she was transferred to Louisiana. I don't understand why it took the government nearly 24 hours from her detention to let me know her whereabouts. DHS would have been made aware of the Habe filing last night. Why she was transferred to Louisiana despite the court's order is unfathomable. Rumaysa should immediately be brought back to Massachusetts, released, and allowed to return to complete her PhD program. Our country is built upon a system of laws and accountability. We look forward to her having her day in court.
Stand up, fight back!
Stand up, fight back!
Hello, everyone. My name is Nicole, and I am an East Somerville resident, and I am one of the volunteer coordinators of the Somerville Ice Watch Network. The city of Somerville and many other cities in Massachusetts call ourselves a sanctuary city, but what does that really mean if our neighbors are being disappeared by state violence for weeks and there's been silence and inaction? What our community needs to know is that how horrifying this incident and Rumaysa's kidnapping may be, this is the terror and the threats that our immigrant neighbors live under every single day.
My name is Sam Alterman. I am a PhD grad worker at Tufts University, and I am proud to be one of the head stewards for the Tufts University Graduate Workers Union, SEIU 509. I'm even more proud to call Rumaysa Ozturk a colleague, a union sibling, and a friend. Our union stands shoulder to shoulder with Rumaysa, with Mahmoud Khalil and Mamadou Ta'al, and with every worker in the United States who is attacked for exercising their free speech rights. We believe that all workers, regardless of citizenship, visa status, or documentation, have a right to be safe in their workplace and in their communities, to speak their minds without fear of retaliation or harassment, and to participate in civic life. 100 years ago, during the first and second Red Scares, the federal government also attempted to shamelessly and violently abuse immigration law to chill free speech and attack working people. The labor movement fought back then, and we need to fight back now.
Yeah, Leah Kayali, and I'm with the Palestinian Youth Movement. We had hundreds of Bostonians coming out here today because they are angered about what happens when one of our community members was taken by armed agents of the state who kidnapped her from outside of her home. People are here to stand up for the movement that she was punished for supporting, the movement for a free Palestine and to end the genocide in Gaza, and they're also here to continue to support our immigrant neighbors who have been getting picked up by ICE ever since, you know, not just Trump came into office, but Biden before him and every administration. So we are out here to continue to demand a free Palestine, to demand ICE out of our communities, and to fight for collective liberation.
I'm Fatima Ahmed. I'm with Muslim Justice League.
Can you describe what happened to Rumaysa?
Yeah, so as far as we understand, you know, Rumaysa was actually under surveillance maybe for a day or two by ICE agents. So her neighbors actually reported seeing these cars, you know, parked on the street for about 2 days. And then she was on her way to an iftar with her friends. And you can see very clearly in the video that, you know, these people just surround her and take her. They don't, you know, explain who they are. There's no indication on their, you know, no vests, nothing, no badges or anything. And so neighbors who saw this were, of course, frightened and reported it, assuming that it was ICE, and it was ICE, in fact, that took her. I think 9/11 and the war on terror was obviously a huge escalation in not just surveillance and policing, but the structure of the government, right? Creating the Department of Homeland Security, creating ICE, which are now, you know, these massive departments eating up our budgets and coming for our community members. And every step of the way, you know, many community members have spoken out and said, we can't accept these things. We can't keep adding more and more surveillance, more and more policing, more and more militarization. It will eventually come for all of us. And I think this is the moment where a lot of people realize it is coming for everybody.
That was some of the voices from over 1,000 protesters who gathered near Tufts University Wednesday evening to protest the kidnapping of Tufts doctoral student Rumaysa Ozturk by ICE agents in Somerville, Massachusetts. Audio gathered by Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Can be heard 5 days a week at WORT and any time at all at democracynow.org. Following her kidnapping, Rumeysa Ozturk was flown 15,000 miles away, 1,500 miles away to a detention center in Louisiana, despite a court order that she not be moved out of Massachusetts without a 48-hour notice. She was neither charged with a crime nor given the opportunity to speak with a lawyer during that time. A federal judge on Friday temporarily blocked her deportation. An Italian politician proposed a law that would automatically assign a baby the mother's surname instead of the father's. This comes after a court ruling that would have automatically had both surnames in the order the parents decided. Unless it was agreed, their children would take just one of them. This topic had been buried by the right-wing coalition that came to power before being revived. The politician states that this would compensate for a centuries-long injustice and mark the shift from patriarchy to matriarchy. Like in many countries, children in Italy are automatically given the father's surname, with the mother's surname permitted only if the father is absent from the child's life. The politician was mostly applauded by other opposition members, with others calling it an attempt at media attention. Six women in India were elected, but their husbands were sworn in instead of them. The practice of unofficial substitutions is common in India. While seats are supposed to be set aside for women according to a 1992 law, the actual intention of the law is not often followed. The goal was to uplift the next generation of women. Instead, the women who were supposed to take the seats end up serving as deputies to their husbands. The national government has recognized the problem. It commissioned a report in 2023 aimed at eliminating efforts for proxy participation. And last month, it proposed exemplary penalties against husbands who usurp their wives' roles. Latin American women are choosing to turn away from traditional gender roles of motherhood to seek new ones. Birth rates have declined more in Latin America than any other country. A group called Nunca Madres, which translates to Never Mothers, provides support and information to women that have felt pressured into motherhood to make an informed choice for their future. The goal is to create a safe space for Latina women to discuss social issues and cultural taboos regarding decisions about motherhood. The top reason women cite for choosing not to have children is economic. This includes the risk of losing their jobs, career prospects, and the unpaid labor of raising a child. If governments want to raise birth rates, Nunca Madres says, the solution is to provide more social care, like paid paternity leave, better health care, and easier access to child care. A New York Times investigation found that powerful people in Kenya, Uganda, and Saudi Arabia have incentives to keep the flow of workers moving despite widespread abuse. Many East African officials own staffing companies that send women to Saudi Arabia to work as housekeepers or nannies. The promise is that these women will make enough money to afford a house and an education for their children. The reality is that women often return ground down by unpaid wages, beatings, starvation, and sexual assault. Some are broke and others are in coffins. In the past 5 years, at least 274 Kenyan workers have died in Saudi Arabia. Many Ugandans have died too, but their government does not release that data. Roughly 500,000 Kenyan and Ugandan workers are in the kingdom today, according to Saudi Arabia government. One young mother jumped from a third-story roof to escape her abusive employer, breaking her back. Another woman was sent home pregnant and broke after her boss had raped her. Some women were only allowed 4 hours of sleep a night, while others were assaulted with bleach. Instead of suspending workers' transfers over the deteriorating conditions, many officials have only increased workers' transfers without protections that other leaders have demanded.
Einen recht schönen guten Abend, meine Damen und Herren. Ich begrüße Sie recht herzlich zu unserem heutigen Fernsehprogramm und wünsche Ihnen einen recht guten Empfang.
The Trump administration pulled research funding for a grant meant to protect women from domestic violence because it was categorized as DEI. The leading cause of death among pregnant and postpartum women is homicide by a domestic partner. The goal of the program was to create a three-day hybrid training program for OBGYNs, public health researchers, and other clinicians across the country to help spot and measure the correlation between domestic violence and pregnancy. It was deemed DEI because it included keywords like women and female inequity. More than 300,000 pregnant people are abused each year by an intimate partner, and that number is likely to increase as more people stay pregnant after the fall of Roe v. Wade. Since the landmark Supreme Court decision, calls to the National Domestic Violence Hotline about intimate partner violence specific to pregnancy and reproductive health doubled across the country. Tuesday was Equal Pay Day, a symbolic day a woman would have to work to have earned as much as a white man during the prior year. This day fell short during an unprecedented period of governmental upheaval. With unprecedented mass layoffs, President Trump's reshaping of labor boards, and a targeted backlash to diversity, many gains among the federal workforce could disappear. While data is not available for Trump's current staff, women working under his first year in office earned 69 cents to every dollar a man made. The national wage gap at the time was 82 cents per dollar. Trump's recent tampering with labor board functions means that nobody is monitoring business practices as to whether or not they're discriminating. A potential incoming recession means historically disadvantaged workers will be impacted first. President Trump's promise to eliminate any policy promoting diversity, equity, and inclusion are threatening decades-long efforts to improve how the United States studies women and queer people's health. Agency employees have been warned not to approve grants that include the words women, trans, or diversity. This would mean halting efforts to improve understanding of conditions that predominantly affect women, including endometriosis, menopause, infectious diseases contracted in pregnancy, and pregnancy-related death. It will also have monumental impacts on LGBTQ plus people and people of color who are already under-researched patients. The U.S. already lags behind in promoting scientific inquiry that considers how sex and gender influence health, with recent history focusing its research on white men. Up until 1993, clinical trials were not legally required to include women and those from disadvantaged backgrounds. Only time will tell how bad the ramifications will be, with many students looking for postdoctoral positions outside of the U.S. This will hurt science overall and cause a brain drain from the United States. The potential revival of an abortion ban from 1849 has many in the country closely watching Wisconsin's upcoming April 1st election. The winner of the election could hold the power to determine whether the 1849 abortion ban will be reactivated. This race has voters deciding between Susan Crawford and Brad Schimmel in the most expensive judicial election in history. While this is technically a nonpartisan election, Crawford is viewed as the liberal choice supporting women's access to reproductive health care, and Schimmel is viewed as a conservative who wants to keep the abortion ban on the books. Elon Musk and groups he funded have spent $20 million to influence the Wisconsin election in favor of Schimmel, and his super PAC is offering $100 to those who sign a petition in opposition to activist judges, also widely seen as an influencing tactic. Elon Musk says a Wisconsin voter has been awarded $1 million days before the election. Coincidentally, his company Tesla has a pending lawsuit in Wisconsin that could end up before the Supreme Court. An important election is coming up this week. It could change the liberal-conservative balance of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, putting reproductive freedom at risk. It could put a woman who believes in private education in charge of the public schools in our state. And another important item on the ballot would enshrine Wisconsin's strict voter law, ID law, in the state constitution. And although polls show a lot of support for voter ID, many folks are voting no. Her Turn reporter Arlene Zoucha has the story with someone who has a personal experience with the issue.
Night, March 12th, one of the candidates for Wisconsin Supreme Court, Brad Schimmel, stated during the debate with Susan Crawford that the current voter ID law never cost anyone. I beg to differ.
That's Danielle Devereaux Weber.
Here's my personal experience as an older white woman after the voter ID law was enacted under Walker. I took my driver's license to the Department of Motor Vehicles to get it renewed under the new voter ID law. Luckily, I had brought a notarized copy of my birth certificate, but that turned out not to be sufficient. I was informed that since my last name had changed when I got married in 1973 and therefore did not match my birth certificate, my marriage certificate was required. This was even though I had voted under my married name in every election since 1973. So I went home to get my copy of my marriage certificate and then hustled back to the DMV. Since the certificate was so old, pre-computer, it was a carbon copy, and the DMV personnel would not accept it. I then had to learn how to acquire and then pay for a certified copy of my marriage certificate and bring that in to the DMV. In total, I had to spend well over $100, not counting gas, to restore my right to vote. Luckily, I could afford it, but this kind of thing should not be enshrined in the state constitution.
Danielle Devereaux Weber is sharing her story because she wants people to know how the voter ID law can disenfranchise people, even someone who doesn't have affordability or other obstacles to getting an ID. Research has shown that almost 15% of eligible voters lack a valid ID. Advocates for voting rights say the voter ID requirement should not be enshrined in the state's constitution and are urging a no vote on this spring's ballot referendum. To understand this issue further, I talked with Anita Johnson. She is the outreach and voting specialist at Milwaukee's Souls to the Polls. The group just held a successful early voting campaign last Sunday with buses from a number of churches to help people get to vote. Johnson makes presentations, canvasses, and makes sure there are flyers in the neighborhood so everyone knows about their right to vote, and she's been doing it for several years now. Why are you so passionate about voting rights? Why is it important to you?
It didn't start off being important to me. Like everybody else, I started out as a job. And after getting this job, I didn't realize that people really did not know their rights at the polls. I was at a polling site where the Hmong population were, and people at that site were telling me that the Hmongs did not vote. And the reason why they didn't vote was because people laughed at them because they didn't understand the English and were afraid to ask questions when they went to the polls to vote. At that time, I went to one of the high schools where the Hmong population students went and talked to the teachers there to see if the students could be poll workers at that polling site. So when the Hmong residents came in to vote, they will feel more comfortable talking to someone who looks like them. And that turned out very well. And so from there, my passion started to grow about voting rights.
The April 1st ballot will have a question to put Wisconsin's voter ID law into the state's constitution. What kind of concerns do you have about putting a voter ID law into our constitution?
I feel that our election integrity is on the line if we pass this. This will cause chaos and confusion. Wisconsin has one of the strictest voter ID law in the nation. We have had a hard enough time educating the public about the proper documents that they needed for the Wisconsin state voter ID law. It was confusing to low-income people, African-Americans, people with disabilities, and the homeless. The real ID goes into effect in May, and many of the public still do not know that they will have to have this ID. I feel that we will only disenfranchise the voter with this law.
Do you have some specific examples of people who will be affected by this law?
Sure. A lot of times people lose their documents and they're afraid to go to the DMV because they don't know what to do or their documents are stolen. There are times when people just don't have the money to go and get an ID and they don't know that you can get a free ID if you go to the DMV and say, you know, I need an ID so I can vote. The homeless, I find, are more worried about getting food in their stomach and a place to sleep for the night instead of getting an ID. So there's many, many reasons, again, why people don't have IDs.
For someone listening who doesn't have an ID right now, what kind of advice would you give them?
The advice would be this. If you're a new resident to Wisconsin, you should go to the DMV and have the following documents. Proof of residence, your birth certificate, at least know your social security number. If you do not have these documents, do not be afraid to go to the DMV. Go to the DMV and tell them, I need an ID so I can vote for the April 1st election. The DMV has a petition process, and they will have you to fill out the petition form, and they will follow up with you as to who you are, where you say you were born, and all that, and they will give you a temporary ID that will last for about 6 weeks, so you can vote on the April 1st election. When you go to the DMV to get your ID, tell them, I need an ID so I can vote, and you will not have to pay for that state ID. This is not for your driver's license. It's for your state ID. The other thing that I would like to say is make sure when you go to get your ID that you get the real ID, which will go into effect in May. The real ID has a star in the upper right-hand corner of your ID. You will be able to board planes and go into federal buildings with this ID. Of course, if you have a passport, you could always use that. But the thing is, you do need this ID if you're going to travel within the U.S. If you have already updated your driver's license or your state ID, make sure you go back and say, I don't have that star. I need the real ID. You will have to pay a small fee for that.
Do you get the feeling that people are excited about this upcoming April 1st election?
People really still don't know about this election. They don't know anything about the candidates. They don't know what the Supreme Court does. I have created a PowerPoint that talks about the circuit court, the mini court, the Supreme Court, and the judges and what they do in these courts. And when I do my presentation, I talk about these courts so people get a mini idea of what the court does and how it will affect them when they go to the court. I strongly suggest that, you know, you need to investigate the people that are running. Make sure their values are the same as yours. See what their platform is. I understand that there's a lot of money being pumped in Wisconsin, and we need to know that Wisconsin will not be bought by any entity. We need to vote for the people who will represent us.
That was Anita Johnson, Outreach and Voting Specialist with Souls to the Polls, Milwaukee. And before that, you heard Danielle Devereaux Weber recounting her personal experience with voter ID. If you have questions about getting a voter ID or the reasons to keep it out of the state constitution, there are a number of ways you can find out more. You can check out the websites from the League of Women Voters, the Department of Transportation, or the Wisconsin Elections Commission. The election, which will also determine the makeup of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, as well as who is our state superintendent of schools, will be this Tuesday, April 1st. No fooling. For her turn, I'm Arlene Zoucha.
Sources used in assembling today's program include Democracy Now!, Reuters, The Huffington Post, The Guardian, Salon.com, The New York Times, The 19th News, The Associated Press, State Court Magazine, State Court Report, and Ms. Magazine. Today's edition of Her Turn was produced by Christina Kivlin and Joanne Powers, who was also our on-air engineer. Other contributors include Arlene Zoucha and Eliza Howard. Now stay tuned for 2.5 hours of Women in Music on Her Infinite Variety with host DJ Siggy. For Her Turn, I'm Christina Kivlin, and remember, a woman's place is in the resistance.